tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing interviews with Mike and Bonnie Hartley, who together, using the pseudonym Thomas Morin, and you will hear Bonnie explain how they came up with that, to write their very first novel. Both Mike and Bonnie have had long and distinguished careers, different careers, that although they required a certain amount of writing, did not include the writing of fiction. And yet, they both took to this idea of writing a novel as the proverbial ducks to water, and you can hear their passion and the excitement with which they have taken on this task. I have to say now that while I have a complete interview with Bonnie, I interviewed Mike and promptly forgot to push the record button. So I do not have my whole interview with Mike. I did realize that I wasn't recording him, and so I asked him some questions, which you will hear him answer, and I also asked him to read something from the book. So while you didn't get all the information that Mike has to offer, you do get an opportunity to hear him talk, and you get a real sense of his commitment to this work. But then both Mike and Bonnie are people who are committed completely to everything they do. They are engaging and interesting and enjoyable. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
sounds simple, but in fact, it turns out that for most of us, it's the most difficult thing to do. It turns out that many of us, maybe even most of us, have grown up thinking that there's something terribly wrong with us, something not good enough, and so we're pretending not to be who we are, but someone else, the person other people would like, want, hire, love, protect, keep. As a psychotherapist, of course, I believe that this not liking who we are thing happens in childhood, in our family of origin, at school. Unfortunately, it happens so often at school. Our religious teaching, our cultural teaching, convinces us that something about us, what we look like, what we sound like, how we sneeze, how we laugh, how smart we are, how fast we are, how healthy we are, whatever it is unattractive, is not what they want, is not what a good person should be, is not what God wants. Something about us makes us undesirable. And that makes us want to pretend to be somebody we're not. And so, unfortunately, so many of us do precisely that. And in our zeal to pretend to be someone else, we quite often forget who we really are. And in having done that, we deny, block, forget really important things about ourselves. Our spontaneity, our joy, our creativity, our curiosity, our assertiveness. These things get buried over and over and over again. Having to pretend that you are not who you are, having to lose the access to these important things, it makes life less delightful, happy than it could be. The intention of the Lilin Show is to say that just because this happened to you in your childhood, just because you figured out a way to pretend, to camouflage, to forget that there are these things about you, doesn't mean that your entire life has to be spent that way. The intention of the Lilin Show is to hopefully alert you to the fact that there may be things which you are in denial for. There may be things that your childhood forced you to hide. And you may now be living a life which is a third, a half, three quarters of the life that actually belongs to you. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I talk about the kinds of things that cause people to hide parts of themselves, to become ashamed of and therefore forget that there are important things about them that they had to leave behind. The book explains how this can happen and what you can do to recover those things which your life would benefit from, those things which would enhance your life. So if, for example, you had parents who were made uncomfortable by forthright, blunt, outgoing, stand-up-for-themselves children, and you were told that old wheeze, children should be seen and not heard, or some variation on that. They don't have to say it out loud. It can be that when you present your argument, you know, very forcefully, or you laugh out loud at the table, or you tell somebody you think they're wrong, you can get any kind of response that tells you that that's not okay. They can roll their eyes. They can turn away. They can change the subject. They can say, you know, that's not nice. Anything up to and including leave the table, no son or daughter of mine does stuff like that. You will be punished for that. You will be hit for that. And in those circumstances, of course, you learn that that's not going to work in that system. But as an adult, the inability to stand up for yourself, the inability to say, this is what I think, the inability to have spontaneity, that really costs you. In the book, I tell the story of this young woman who was about 5 years old, and her mommy took her to a birthday party for another little person. And the mother in this of the birthday child had presents for everyone. And the presents were all laid out in the living room, and all of the little children got numbers, and you could go up and get a present based on your number. This little girl got number one. She was absolutely delighted, and she rushed over to the presents, and she picked the biggest present. "Put that back," her mother said. "It's not nice to take the biggest present." She dropped it like it was hot and picked something small and ran back to hide. Today, when she deserves a raise at work, today, when someone says something unkind to her, today, when she wants to go out for Chinese food but somebody else wants to go for Italian food, today, whenever there is something she wants, and she wants to be able to stand up for herself and say, "No, I want that," without conscious awareness, she can hear her mother's voice. Today, when you talk to her about that and she tells you the story, she can feel the rush of shame. Her face gets red. She can feel precisely what that little five-year-old felt. So you can see how this lesson, which she learned at five, is dictating her life and dictating how happy, how comfortable, how much her life can reflect who she really is and what she really wants. And this is in no way unusual. This is way too common. So this young woman presents herself as someone who doesn't have strong desires, who doesn't care. She uses phrases like, "whatever you want," and "I don't mind," and "no, I don't care. It's okay with me." These are her favorite phrases. She presents as easygoing and accepting and not demanding and not controlling. In fact, she is none of these things. She's bitter and angry and depressed, but the person that she demonstrates, that she presents, I call that a cover story. In the book, I talk about the cover story being the way we decided it was safe to present ourselves. Much as a spy has a cover story, and you know that the spy's cover story is designed to protect them. If they are known to be who they really are, then they are in danger. Well, our cover stories are the same. We design them to protect us from danger. For this little girl, saying, "I want that," was dangerous. Mommy's wrath was not something to fool around with. And she learned to pretend that she was someone who really never said, "I want that." She was someone who never made a fuss, never took something that someone else might want, never looked demanding. She talked about herself as a compromiser, as someone who always wanted to make peace, someone who always wanted to help others. Now, all of that was really the truth, but it was a cover story. And a cover story, while it is the truth, is just not the entire story. So while I've been talking about this, have you been thinking that there's a quality of yours that you wish you didn't have? Or is there a quality that you wish you did have? Are you envious of people who speak their mind? They don't seem to be thinking out what they're going to say. They just, the words just come right out of their mouth. Whereas you are always thinking through the consequences of what you're going to say before you say it. Are you jealous of or envious of people who do a certain skill. Maybe they dance with abandon, or maybe they sing, even if they sing off key, or maybe they sculpt, and you've always thought it would be wonderful to sculpt. Are there things you have wanted to do? Are there ways that you have wanted to be, but you just don't feel like that's okay? Something always stops you? So again, if while I'm speaking, you have thought that there is some way that you would want to be, something that you would want to do, but something stops you? In the book, I say over and over again, if something stops you, there's a very good reason. And if you know that reason and you can deal with that reason, then maybe you don't have to be stopped. If you have thought of something you would like to change in your life and you'd like some help with that, you can get a copy of my book. Again, that's When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can get that at my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynshow.com. At my website, you can also click on Email Me and ask me any questions or make any comments. I'll be happy to hear from you. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. Also, you can listen to all the interviews that I have done, including the ones you're about to hear. In this show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because when you listen to people who make their living or their life with an art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Today, I'm airing interviews with two people who have written their first novel. The novel is Broken Trust. It's intriguing and compelling and delightful, and I heartily recommend it. The writers are Bonnie and Mike Hartley, writing under the pseudonym Thomas Morin. You will hear Bonnie explain how they arrived at that title. Bonnie and Mike make their living in another way, but both of them are writers. Even in the work that they do, which is not completely about writing, they have written several books and writings in many other forms. First, I'm going to play the interview I did with Bonnie, and then I am embarrassed to say that I got deeply into the interview with Mike before I realized I had forgotten to push record. And so my interview with Mike will be a little odd, but I will explain more about that when we get to it. First, I'm going to play my interview with Bonnie, which fortunately I did manage to record all of. Bonnie is an extraordinary person. She is most definitely who she really is and has always been. And you will hear as she talks about how she arrived at a time in her life when she decided to write a novel, you will hear how she followed who she is methodically, discovering on the way things about herself that she didn't know, but the minute she discovered them, she followed them. So here now is my interview with the remarkable Bonnie Hartley. Okay, so I'm here with Bonnie Hartley, who is half of the writing team of Thomas Morin, who has written their first book called Broken Trust, which I have read and is really wonderful, really, really wonderful. Now, I know Bonnie in another context, so what I would like to ask you is I'd like to talk about Bonnie the writer.
Okay.
Okay? So I want to know if there are any experiences in your early life that suggested to you that you might want to write.
Yes.
Really? Well, tell me then.
Well, not in my early childhood, but in my young adult life when I was living in Spain, I remember walking down the street in Madrid thinking, someday I'm going to be a writer. I just don't have enough experience yet.
Wow. What were you doing in Spain?
I had a Fulbright fellowship, and I was studying a contemporary Spanish poet, and I eventually wrote my dissertation on his poetry.
Who?
His name was José Hierro, and he is now a very established, well-known poet. At the time that I was working on him in 1973, he was considered a social poet, and meaning that he was only presenting a message and that it wasn't necessarily artistic. And my love of his poetry came from his use of narrative voice, his use of perspective and of rhythm and metaphor and all the things that to me make poetry interesting. I was less interested in the message.
I see. Less interested in what other people were interested in.
Yes. That's always been the case.
Yes. Yes, I think I know that. Okay, so you were already interested in writers and writing.
Oh, yes.
How did that happen?
I've been teaching Spanish literature, poetry. I've been fascinated with language from the time I was young, and I started studying Spanish when I was 12.
Well, wait a minute. Fascinated by language when you were young. What do you remember about that?
Well, I love the sound of words. I love the rhythm of how people speak and how they, the flow of what they say.
Do you remember having that as a conscious thought when you were a girl?
Mm-hmm. It's like I love music for the same reason. I think that the heart and the soul listen to the sounds more than the words. I was always interested in content. I mean, I used to listen to music when I was very young and I was an insomniac, and I would listen to songs when I would try to go to sleep, and I had to stop doing that because I always got hung up on the story and the songs.
Were you listening to the radio?
Uh-huh.
You were an insomniac as a child?
I was a terrible insomniac. My father finally built me a radio with a headset, and I listened to baseball games all over the country, and that would put me... I love baseball, but listening to the games would engage my mind so that it would eventually stop.
This is so interesting to me because it's all sound and it's all auditory,
mm-hmm.
Right? So at some point you fell in love with the Spanish language?
When I was 12. I don't know why. I just loved Spanish and I started studying it when I was 12.
In school? Uh-huh. Outside of school?
In school. Idaho, in a little tiny town in Idaho with no reference points. There was nothing. I just, from that age, I just wanted to study Spanish and I wanted to live in Spain, and that was my focus.
Wow. That is kind of ironic, you know, and unusual. You do
yes.
know that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So, there's this love of Spanish, there's this love of words, there's really this love of writing, and it wasn't until how old were you in Spain at the Fulbright?
I was in my early 20s.
So it wasn't until then that it occurred to you that you too might be a writer?
Right.
It's kind of interesting.
I mean, I wrote poetry, but I always did it for myself. I did it as a processing vehicle.
In the way that, to put down what you thought or felt, mm-hmm. not because you thought of yourself as a writer, but just because you wanted to get this stuff out.
I didn't want to, I had to.
Had to, yeah. Right. And you did it in the form of poetry, not in the form of stories or essays or
mm-hmm.
or journals or diaries, or right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, so you're walking along the street in Spain and you think, one of these days I'll be a writer, but I don't have enough experience. This is so interesting. What did you think the experience, I don't know how to phrase this, did you think that you had to live a certain number of years, that you had to have a certain number of human experiences, that what you thought or felt at that time was not enough, it wasn't significant, it wasn't, do you know?
It wasn't a matter of being significant, I just didn't think I had enough experience, I didn't have enough depth of understanding of people, and so. And about 4 years after that, I did write a mystery.
You did?
Uh-huh. And then I burned it.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Why?
Well, if I want to write another book, I will.
Right.
I don't have to have this, and I burned it. But the irony was that the main character in the book, was a woman who was an international business consultant. This was when I was teaching poetry. I mean, she was an international business consultant. She lived in Sun Valley, Idaho, and she worked for high net worth clients and solved problems for them, solved. And it was before I ever had any inkling that I would go into business. I thought of myself as an academic.
This is quite remarkable, of course. You wrote your own future.
I did.
Essentially, right? Mm-hmm. Without knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in a way, you did that with teaching writing. I mean, you were presaging yourself. I don't know if that's the right word.
I wasn't teaching how to write fiction or poetry. I was helping people learn how to read and understand what other people wrote.
I'm not sure that that's that far away.
Well, I had to help them learn how to write because they had to express
right.
what they thought about the... So I did. I mean, I taught in some ways. I taught Spanish grammar and taught...
Well, you knew all that stuff about perspective and narrative. You knew all that stuff.
Well, and what was interesting to me, what I still think is interesting about my dissertation, was that I focused on the relationship between the narrator, not the writer, but the narrator, the person reading the book, and the text. And it was that dynamic interaction that interested me, what the narrative voice was, and how the reader, with his or her own perspective, engaged with that narrator, and how that experience of the text would be different for every reader.
Wow.
I mean, that was my understanding. That's what I took away from the years I spent
studying
all that.
Really, really,
yeah.
Okay.
And I still think that's true.
So, a thumbnail on how you got into business and how you became the character in your mystery.
Well, I left the academic world, and I thought, being an intellectual, I thought, well, I better go back and go to law school. So I got into law school, and I went back to Sun Valley. I'm from Idaho, and I'd lived in Ketchum and Haley and before, and so I went back there, and I was just going to spend the summer, and I was really, I think, pretty exhausted, and I was there. I just was able to recoup. I could lie on the grass and look at the sky and just think whatever I wanted to think and relax, that there wasn't any pressure. And I realized that I didn't want to spend three more years reading six-point font, and that what I wanted was to stay there. But I went back to the university where I was an assistant dean and I was teaching. And I asked for a one-year sabbatical, and they gave it to me. And at the end of that 1 year, I decided not to go back because I had created my first business. I had no idea that I was an entrepreneur. I mean, I had always assumed I would just be an academic because my mother was a teacher, my grandmother was a teacher, and it was what, I was a good teacher. I knew that. But it didn't spark the same kind of enthusiasm for me as sort of the scariness and thrill of creating my own business and running it. And so I started there, and I had two focuses. I worked first with people who were in the middle of some big change in their life. And I worked with them to sort out what their options were and how they might weigh their choices. And that was very satisfying to me. So I was consulting. And Sun Valley, it was and still is a community of very high net worth people, and also the community of people that support those people. And I got involved in starting a hospice and doing, I was on the community education board, and I did a lot of things there, and I loved living there. And I realized that I loved business. I just was fascinated with it.
Who knew?
And I had a client who was a retired, very successful retired real estate developer contractor from LA. And I was talking to him, and he said, I mean, he was working with me on some things, and he came to see me, and he said, you know, I think you should go back and get your MBA, because you're really doing strategic planning with people, but you don't have any credentials or credibility in the business world to be doing what you're doing. He said, you're very good at it, and I think that you would really flourish if you did that. I said, I don't think so. But at that time, my sister was teaching at Oregon State in Corvallis, and she called me and said, you know, there's a family business program, and they're looking for someone who will come in and get an MBA and run the program while the director's on sabbatical. I said, no way. I'm not going back to school. And so she, being very linear, said, tell me all the reasons you won't do it. And I did, and then she went through all of them and said, well, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this. And so I went.
Life saying this,
yeah.
Now, right?
And it was a great experience. It challenged me because I'm not very, I didn't have a lot of confidence in my math skills and that sort of thing, but they tutored me and I made it through and I learned a lot of stuff that I thought was very interesting.
And then you became the person who essentially was your alter ego in that original mystery.
Right.
I love that. I just love that.
Right. And it was, there was a Spanish component to it because it was about a Basque terrorist who had blown something up in Spain and had fled to Idaho and was living under a false identity, and because there's a big Basque community in Idaho, was living there. And I can't even remember now all the twists, but she somehow
uncovers
pulled
him.
All of that.
Right, 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 right. Okay, so clearly, although, my God, there are so many twists and turns in your own life, so many different careers, ways of being, ways of thinking about yourself, now when you are, in fact, a business person, a consultant who works with high net worth clients and solves their problems, at this time, you also decided to do what apparently you had thought of doing, what, I don't know, how many years ago in Spain, mm-hmm. and that is write a novel and do that with your current husband, mm-hmm. Mike Hartley, under the name Thomas Maurin. So say something about the etiology of that, how that happened, and something about the book to give us a taste of it.
Mike and I were in Brussels to give a presentation at the Family Business Network, which is a big conference for very high net worth families. And I had presented before there, and we worked on a presentation together and went there to deliver it. And in our free time, we went to the Museum of Money, among other things. And at that museum, there was an exhibit of the history of Belgians' lost gold that they lost when the Nazis invaded both Belgium and France, and Mike can tell you more about the details of that. He's very enthusiastic about that. So we started talking about how it would be fun to write a novel together. And I'm a big mystery thriller fan. I read them voraciously. And so we just started playing around, and we started inventing these characters. Mike started working on the history of that era because he's very interested in World War II, and I started creating these characters, the three main characters. And I did that by going back and doing genograms, which are like family trees, four generations back. And so I had to do a lot of research, and I just invented these families. And then I also did their astrological charts. And that I did as a way of trying to see what the harmonics would be among these three characters. And so we just gathered all this research, and we really only worked on it about 2 weeks a year, because we would do a writing retreat in the Cayman Islands once a year.
So at some point, this solidified into, we are going to do this, mm-hmm. and the way we're going to do this is to set aside these 2 weeks in the Cayman Islands for as long as it takes, mm-hmm. and work on it. So how long did it take?
6 years.
But it didn't matter.
No, we had a blast doing it.
Yeah.
And so we just would go, and we got hung up. I rewrote the first chapter probably 3,000 times, or maybe just 100. And we finally decided, we had several chapters, maybe 8. We knew what the whole sort of story was going to be, but we decided to hire an editor,
mm-hmm.
because we'd never written fiction.
Yeah.
And so we went to a business editor we'd used for our business publications, and she said, well, I don't do fiction, but I know somebody in L.A. who does. So we contacted our editor, Laura Matthews, and we invited her to come to Oregon, where we have a summer house, and she came and spent a weekend with us and gave us an intensive writing seminar and gave us a list of books we had to read about writing and about how you integrated plot and story and what plot and story arcs were and all these things. And then she helped us come up with a sort of a storyboard. And then we worked with her for 2 years pretty intensively. And we pulled it together. And in the process of doing it, we realized that this was not a one-story deal, that these characters who really had come alive for us had a lot more to say, and they had a lot more to do. And so we just decided we would do a series, which we've called The Three Musketeers. And we're now working on the second book, and which is called Broken Web, and the third book will be called Broken Code.
Oh, it's lovely.
So that's how we did it.
So it turns out that you were right. And apparently at the moment that you thought you had enough experience, you did in fact become a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are a writer. Both you and Mike have written any number of serious work, but
right.
Not novels. No.
And this was our first foray into fiction, and we had such a good time doing it that we're going to keep doing it.
That's great. Okay, so the book is Broken Trust, and the author is Thomas Morin, and you can get it at Amazon.
Yes.
Just go up on Amazon and ask for it, right?
Right, and be sure, there are a lot of books called Broken Trust.
Uh-huh.
So you have to put in the author's name, Thomas Morin.
And it is Maurin.
Right.
Do you want to say how you came up with that?
Sure. We thought, well, if we're going to have a pen name, which we did because we wanted to differentiate the fiction from the nonfiction. So Mike's middle name is Thomas. My middle name is Maureen. And we thought, well, it could either be Maureen
Thomas.
Or Thomas Morin, chopping the E off.
Mm-hmm.
So we flipped a coin.
Aha! Uh-huh.
And that's how we came up with our
name. Well, all right, you will not forget it. It's Thomas Morin, not quite Thomas Maureen.
Exactly.
All right. I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Okay, so from that interview, you get some idea of the intelligence and the curiosity and the breadth of interests that are Bonnie Hartley. And it makes me even more unhappy that you are not going to hear these same things from Mike, whose intelligence, curiosity, and breadth of interests is staggering. But you're not going to get to hear that because I have technological difficulty. But what you are going to get to hear is I asked Mike, he had mentioned that there was a prequel to the series. You heard Bonnie talking about the fact that they conceived of this early on as a trilogy. And Mike is going to talk about the prequel and how they arrived at that. And following that, I asked Mike to read something from the book, and so we're going to have that. But now, the very little that you can hear of the quite amazing Mike Hartley. Bonnie told me that you wrote, and or you told me, I don't remember now who told me, that the second book is already plotted. But now you tell me that there's a prequel, or that's
right.
The second book?
No.
No.
The second book takes the characters of Broken Trust and moves them forward in time.
Right.
And it's still attached to the events that they just came from in Broken Trust, and then it's kind of another part of their journey. But to prepare for Broken Trust, we've done a lot of research on the historical elements of around this gold. And we took all that research, because I'm sure she probably told you, one of our character development strategies is to develop their family trees going backward at least four generations.
Yes.
So that we have a real understanding of what their family was doing, who went to school where did they live, whose grandfather worked at what job.
And how they became who they are.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Because that was all, you know, kind of resulted in our characters. And so having all those people, we said, well, let's just go ahead and now that you've read Broken Trust and you kind of see the end of it, let's show the beginning of it. And so going back into the mid-1930s.
So this takes place when?
This is in contemporary times. We
right.
haven't exactly given a date, but this is current day.
Okay,
Broken Trust.
So 1930s would be, what, 70 years ago? Right.
And so now we're into people's grandfathers or aged people's fathers who were young at
right,
that time.
Right, right, right.
And we're going to trace those characters up to how they got the gold, what they did with it, where they took it, which we found out in Broken Trust.
Mm-hmm.
But what were they doing during the rest of the war when they stole the gold and took off?
Wow. Right,
across the ocean, in fact.
And so these people will be the people who gave birth to the people who solved the problem, the mystery
yes.
in Broken Trust.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that stuff. I started reading fiction by reading those books that in the front they have the family tree.
Yes.
You know, and so that's how I fell in love with novels. So this is going to be wonderful for me. And maybe you could put the family tree in the front.
We will, in fact.
I love it. All right, Michael. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to ask you about this. No, I think unless you can think of something that I didn't ask you that really bears on this.
No, the only thing I would add to it is there's a different element of research. Right now I'm researching German naval history to see where the U-boat packs were operating so that I can plot a route for this freighter across the southern Atlantic to end up in Grand Cayman.
So this is giving you an opportunity to do what you love to do, right? Right. And to use it in this new context.
Absolutely.
In the interview which you didn't hear me do with Michael, he said that as a boy, he invented stories for his army men. In a way, this is not so far from
that,
right? You get to go full circle.
Absolutely.
Right? Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Lynn.
And now we have Michael reading from Broken Trust.
"Hold it, Phoebe," Joan said. "If what Fitz just told us is true, that means there's a potential international terrorist incident about to go down tomorrow." "Terrorist incident?" "Not really, Fitz. Charles and Jamie tried to take that in a patriotic spirit, rather than the power grab that it felt like, but it just kept coming. I need to alert the directors of National Intelligence and Homeland Security immediately," Joan went on. "This is way over your heads. You need to give us the intel and then get out of the way so we can avert a national disaster." Turning to Phoebe, Joan ordered, "And what we need is your colleagues' files and whatever other data you've gathered about this bank's history of shady trading. This will give us leverage to approach our colleagues in Swiss intelligence."
You know, maybe you could talk to me a little bit about the plot. Just talking about how they discover it, and give me some kind of an arc of the book.
Sure. The premise of the book really has one of Fitz's colleagues.
Fitz is
the heroine.
Fitz short for something?
For her last name.
Ah, okay.
And that's how she's been known in college. And these three get together. They started off going to school at Harvard and then went their separate ways. In fact, two of them. Fitz and Charles were married briefly during finals week and graduation week at Harvard, but the marriage ended up getting annulled due to some family interference. And so they hadn't seen each other for 20 years. The third member, Jamie, has kept some contact with both of them unbeknownst to the other. And so Charles and Fitz are thrown together by the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation and are brought together. The fact that they once knew each other and were married was completely unknown to the department head. And they were thrown into this because Gary, her colleague at the Securities and Exchange Commission, had been investigating this bank, and he's the one that started to get onto these issues and as a result was killed.
Mm.
And so these two ended up having to pick up the investigation without knowing that it was as big as it was and that it was going to lead into some really dangerous and some internationally sensitive areas.
And in the process, we learn a terrific amount about the history of how Belgium lost all its gold during the Nazi invasion?
Yeah, they were in the enviable position at first of having the largest storehouse of gold in Europe, and this is the late 1930s. On the other hand, the Germans, who had spent most of their gold store arming themselves, also put Belgium in the position of being kind of an indefensible place. They didn't have mountains, they were up against the sea, they were in a very vulnerable position. So they started shipping some of their gold to the United States and to the United Kingdom, and the rest of it, as the Nazis were starting to move and they really sensed danger, they shipped to France to take care of, because that's a big country and what could possibly happen to them. Unfortunately, even though the French hid the gold in Africa to safeguard it, France fell, and the French and the German government entered into a reparations agreement to atone for the wrongs done to Germany during World War I by France, which was pretty much exactly equal to this amount of gold, which was very quickly gotten out of Africa and shipped back up into Berlin. It was melted down, re-smelted, made into ingots with serial numbers and stamps on them, and put into the records of Germany as though it had been in their treasury for years.
Wow. Wow. And that, with that, we're going to let you figure out what happened by reading Broken Trust. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, if you have any interest in mystery or detective fiction, you will love Broken Trust, and you will be, like me, waiting for the sequels and the prequel. You can get your copy of Broken Trust by going up on Amazon.com, writing in Broken Trust. But as Bonnie said, there are a number of books called Broken Trust, so you want to be sure to put the title of the author, Thomas Maurin, M-A-U-R-I-N. Perhaps you can remember that it is Maureen without an E, as I am doing. And I know that you will love it and look forward, as I am, to the rest of them. Listening to Bonnie and to what you could hear of Mike makes the point that I am trying to make with the Lynn Show. The point that I am trying to make with the Lynn Show is that it is possible to be yourself, your whole self, all of who you are. And as I said in the opening, it is unfortunate but nonetheless true that so many of us are forced by something in our childhood, our family of origin, our siblings, our peers, our culture, our school experience, our religion, to think of something about us as not attractive, as going to bring a consequence which we do not want to have. Again, children require support and nourishment and encouragement in order to develop into the person they were born to be, the person that they actually are. So when they get discouragement, criticism, punishment, the development is interrupted. More than interrupted, it's stalled. And as I quite often say, this can be, this can happen through no malice even. A parent who was not encouraged themselves as a child will not have the skill of encouraging, will not know how to encourage. They will do what was done to them. This is, of course, without malice. This is simply what they know. But they will be passing on a legacy of discouragement. A parent who badly needs to feel loved, appreciated, cared for, may find any behavior in the child that is not exactly what they want or need as scary or threatening. And they may need, for their own well-being, to discourage that behavior in the child. So there are lots of reasons why people are discouraged. But in the end, the reason doesn't matter. In the end, when you have gotten the idea that the way you walk or talk or think, the fact that you like to draw or sing or dance, that you're right or left-handed and that doesn't go down well, or that your sexual orientation is embarrassing or threatening to your parents or your culture, any of these things, you wind up either in denial yourself for the thing that you was bringing a consequence you didn't want, or you simply feel damaged, flawed, inadequate. And that is also unfair and leads to a life where you actually cannot succeed in being who you really are. So the Lynn Show is about making the point. If this happened to you, and it's my understanding, my belief, my experience as a therapist, that most of us really know. You know when you don't feel good about yourself. You know when there's something that you yearn to do, that you're jealous of other people because they can do, that you can daydream about but you cannot make yourself do. You know when you feel that there's something about you that you don't want other people to know, that you need to keep a secret, even if you don't know what exactly that is.
you know that. If any of these things strike a chord with you, if any of these things are true for you, the Lin Show is about saying, it is not too late to recover, to retrieve aspects of yourself which you may have had to deny, especially if what you denied was feeling good about yourself. You deserve to feel good about yourself. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, something that intrigued you, something that told you you want to go out and buy Broken Trust. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to